already been ill on that day. It was only in the last 6 months of his life that they had seen each other more often.
My bad, Michael said, as if reading his thoughts. Been meaning to ask you, how are you getting on without your old man?
Damien nodded, fake light-hearted. I'm getting through. The spectre of Stephanie rose before him, with her therapy leaflets.
You miss him?
Not much, I guess. A little.
Not really, though. Look, you don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, bro. I get it.
Damien did think about telling him about the deja vu moment back there, but he was ashamed. Michael wouldn't understand. He came from a happy family where the mother and father were eternally in love, and the children were adored, and did not call their parents by their first names. Instead, he went to get more drinks, after which they talked of other things, eventually returning to the problems with Melissa. It was the pressing issue, and Damien had always been more the listener in their friendship. It also made him feel better about the recent feelings he'd been having, which sitting here, drinking with Michael, he could see were off-key.
What you need is a date, he said. When was the last time you went out alone together?
Last month sometime, Michael said, and just then, as though conjured by the memory of it, Bruce Wiley stopped at their table, a largeness of belly and scruffy jeans, beer in hand. He was with one of his models.
What's up, Mike?
He said, clamping his shoulder in greeting before giving dap.
Hey, big man, you just crossed my mind. That was a bashment to remember, Michael said.
Damien and Bruce shook hands as well, having not seen each other in years.
And where's the mighty Melissa tonight? Asked Bruce. Friday night is date night in a Barmer custom, you know. I hope she's not at home all by herself.
He brings the message, Damien said.
You see? Date night.
We are not the Obamas, Michael said, when Bruce had moved on, running into someone else he knew, which was practically the whole bar.
Doesn't matter. It's the same principle.
I don't like booty schedules. They don't work. It kills the spontaneity. I prefer things ital.
Who's calling it a booty schedule? It's just a date, said Damien.
Look, baby's for a spanner in the works. Take her out, that's all. Go out dancing or to dinner or something. Make her happy.
Oh, that's not easy, to make a woman happy, Michael laughed. Men shouldn't be held responsible for that.
True.
Damien was laughing too.
But you've got to try, at least. Look what's at stake.
Michael thought about it, downing his drink.
Maybe you're right, he said, and looked around again at all the honeys. None of them compared.
We've got to do something, I guess. She's the love of my life.
Okay, I need tops, skirts, trousers, and shoes, Hazel said.
I need a red dress. I don't have a red dress. I'm trying to be more feminine.
You always say that.
I know, and I always end up buying more jeans. Don't let me.
Okay. Where do you usually get your jeans from, by the way? I like your jeans.
Topshop.
Ah, theirs never fit me. I'm too fat. They don't make them for women with hips.
You're not fat, Melissa said. You're Amazonian. Having met at Topshop as planned, they were walking now through the central avenue on the ground floor of Selfridges that led from perfumery to the clothing concessions. Why wade and trawl through the Oxford Street hoi polloi, tramping from shop to shop when you can come here, where everything resides? This was Hazel's view, lover of the department store, frequenter also of John Lewis and House of Fraser. Melissa liked the tramping, albeit less on a Saturday when you could walk only in slow motion. Concessions were only highlights. You missed stuff. Ultimately, she preferred a more bohemian kind of shopping experience, like Portobello or Camden, where from the cubic shade of a market stall a face might look out, lined and wanting, as you touch earrings, pendants, fabrics, and a little hut nearby might sell falafel or mulled wine, and you could drift along drinking it in the cold air, in the strange colourings of light, the charisma of the cobblestones, the dirty sheen of the canal. Department stores had no personality
and they lacked fresh air. And Selfridges was a beast of a department store, a glittering homage to materialism. The shop assistants were like overseers, standing around with their open pots of cream and eau de toilette, their faces extreme with paint. All around them, a dizzying profusion of objects and escalators and wild electricity. High and multiple-ceilinged as it was more of a subterranean experience. It had been some time since Melissa had been shopping for clothes, not since buying maternity wear. Everything looked overbright or overtight, too frilly, clothes for clowns and nubile nymphs, tacky colours, strange concoctions of garments. It was making her feel weary, not excited like it always had. "Look at all this stuff," she said. But Hazel was already delving. "I love this place." She picked up something bright green made of lace with holes in it. "I don't even know what that is."
"It's a dress?"
"Wow." Melissa noticed a grey skirt and held it against her.
Not sure how I feel about pleats."
"Pleats are for schoolgirls and the over 50s. You told me that," Hazel said.
"Did I?"
They trailed the cotton. They perused the chiffons, silks and satins, meanwhile chatting.
"I must come over and see him soon."
Hazel was talking about Blake.
"I'm such a bad godmother. I did warn you, didn't I? Why do you have to live so far?"
"It's not that far. Just go to London Bridge and get a train."
"But a train? An actual train?"
Hazel was one of those Londoners who perceived the South as another state. West was best. The river was the end. Beyond it was no man's land. The streets were alien. The skies were darker. The people were base. She did not understand Melissa's relocation to a random road in such a southernmost enclave, far away from friends, family, and civilization. She herself lived in Hammersmith. Oxford Street was a short bus ride away, or she could take the tube. She only ever took trains to places like Margate, to the provinces.
"You Westerners, you get a nosebleed if you cross the river. It's pathetic," Melissa said.
"I seem to remember you were the same once."
"Yeah, well, I've evolved. Actually, I'm getting used to the train thing. It's good reading time."
"If you say so," Hazel snorted.
"What are you reading? I need some recommendations."
"I'm trying to read Middlemarch, but I'm thinking about giving up. Hemingway, as always, some of his stories. And I just read The Road by Cormac McCarthy. It's good, but very depressing. End of the world kind of thing. I hate those kind of books."
They were long since agreed that Geoffrey Eugenides' Middlesex was one of the best books ever. Melissa liked the corrections, but Hazel didn't so much. She had found it wayward and self-indulgent. She was a fan of The Kite Runner, which Melissa hadn't read yet. As for the Chekhovs, Delmore Schwartz's, Grace Paley's, and the more obscure books Melissa liked to read, Hazel didn't have time for it. She was Melissa's oldest, boldest friend. They had gone to the same primary school. Hazel worked in advertising. She had a wide and glamorous smile behind which was an oft foul tongue and long, bouncing, half-French, half-Ghanaian curls falling down her back. The most beautiful, the most envied of their schoolgirl pack. The one the boys always went for first, and then made do with a lesser girl if she was already taken. She was gutsy, self-actualized, and tactile. Today, she was wearing a clinging blue wool dress, caramel eyeshadow, and high-heeled sock boots, and a red coat. She was that type. She twinkled. At the shoe section, she sat down to try on a pair of pink wedges, but didn't like the way they looked in the mirror. She put them back, and they walked on, passing boiler suits, jeggings, a blind man tapping his stick with a young Asian woman holding his arm, two people with buggies, wide walking. The music coming from the speakers was a Mariah Carey remix. Melissa recommended another book, which Hazel asked her to put aside for her.
"I'll get it when I come and see Blake."
"You don't have to come and see him, you know. I'm always reminding him that you love him. Your main duty as a godparent is that you take him in if something tragic happens to me and Michael. That's if I don't kill him first."
"Don't be silly," Hazel said.
"I'm not being silly."
"You love him. He's your beau."
Melissa had already talked about the current hostilities at Paradise, the tiffs, The time Michael neglected to pack a night bag for Blake when they were visiting his parents. The time he forgot to change his nappy before going to the park, because he didn't think of things like that. Men just don't think of things like that. Meanwhile, Hazel's eyes had started to glaze over, and Melissa, noticing, quickly fell silent, ashamed. Hazel put the arguing down to common post-baby disruption. It would settle down. They just had to keep the peace and enjoy Blake.
Come on, it can't be that bad. You and Michael are solid.
Right now, there is no me and Michael. It just doesn't flow anymore. It's too much like hard work.
Wait.
Hazel paused in her perusing.
You're not thinking of splitting up with him, are you?
No. Kind of. I'm not sure. In a way, it feels like it's happening all by itself, like we could break up any minute.
But you're M&M, I mean, you're chocolate. You can't split up.
Hazel had stopped shopping completely now, and there was a look of dismay and urgency on her face.
If you and Michael broke up, I'd be devastated. You're my favourite couple. You still love him, don't you? Tell me you still love him.
Melissa didn't answer the question.
Chocolate can break, actually, she said instead.
It crumbles when you break it into pieces.
Not M&Ms. It's really hard to break an M&M in half.
They both laughed.
Even if I do love him, Melissa said.
I don't think it's enough.
Of course it is. Now you're just basically being cynical.
Hazel was disturbed, though, by the look of hopelessness on Melissa's face, an absolute lack of faith. Grasping the severity of the situation, she pictured Rhea and Blake without their father, which to her was a terrible thing, a sad and tragic thing.
The children, she said. What about the children?
Melissa had started looking through a rack of tops in French Connection, not really seeing anything, not concentrating. When she thought about the children, she entered the realm of the caves. There were no answers. There was only darkness and fuzz, a sense of groping and things happening as they happened.
They'll be fine, she said, distantly.
As long as they still see both of us, they'll be okay. There are other ways of bringing up kids than the nuclear family, you know.
Why are we even talking about this anyway? I haven't said we're definitely splitting up.
You're not splitting up. Hazel put her arm through Melissa's quite firmly, and they walked on.
You and Michael are perfect for each other. You're just not seeing straight. Do you really want to be a single mother?
What's so wrong with being single? I'd love to be single.
No, you wouldn't.
I would.
You think you would, but you wouldn't. It gets lonely being single. Believe me, I know. You're lucky to have what you've got. A good man who adores you.
Michael's good for you. He's a catch. He's something to be celebrated.
You know what? Your life really started coming together when you met him. Remember you were living in that horrible room in Kensal Rise?
Yeah, and?
And you had to share a bathroom with that horrible girl, and there was that nasty fuckhead upstairs who was threatening you.
What was his name again?
Victor?
Yeah, him.
What about him?
Don't you remember the way Michael looked out for you? That day he was banging on your ceiling and shouting at you, and Michael went up and dealt with him. He protected you. He defended you.
I defend myself. I went up there too, remember? Michael didn't need to be there.
Anyway, the place wasn't that bad. My room was nice.
If it wasn't for Michael, you'd probably still be there.
No, I wouldn't.
You could be.
I wouldn't.
Where would you be then?
That's what I'm always asking myself. Where would I be?
Maybe I'd be somewhere different. Maybe I'd be living in Brazil or Peru or the Caribbean, who knows? Maybe he's holding me back. There might be another way. Another course I'm being kept from. If things hadn't happened the way they did, they would have happened a different way. And that way might have been...
Melissa's phone started ringing. She found it in her bag and answered it.
Hello?
Hi,
said a sprightly voice.
Am I speaking to Melissa Pitt?
Yes.
Hi, it's Chun Song Lee from Baby Beat. How are you today?
Fine. Melissa rolled her eyes at Hazel, who in turn was rolling her eyes at what hippie shit confused rubbish she had just been spouting and now returned to perusing the merchandise.
I was calling to see if you're ready to sign up for 10 weeks. It's 10 for the price of 9. Remember the special offer. And I can also...
I'm shopping. Can I call you back? Melissa said.
Okay, that's fine. There's only 3 days left to take advantage of the revised special offer, though. I'll wait to hear from you.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye!
God, that woman is so pushy. I hate it when people are pushy. It has the opposite effect. Is there no escape from capitalism, from everyone trying to make a buck? Who was it? Hazel was assessing a two-tone blue coat against herself. Oh, just baby stuff. What was I saying?
You were saying that if it wasn't for your gorgeous man, you'd be living in Peru. And there's not only one way of living life, and things might have happened a different way if they hadn't happened the way they'd happened. Or something like that.
Do you know, you seem to have this ridiculous fixation with being strong, and alone, and unconventional, and... what's the word? Resistant. Like you can't just live your life the way other people do. What is that? You're dog-headed. That's what you are. It's going to mess you up. Lots of women would love to be in your position. What do you think of this coat?
I don't know. I think it would hang cheaply.
Hazel put it back.
Do you know what you and Michael need?
What?
You need to spice things up a bit. I bet you haven't fucked in ages, have you? Look, here's one for you.
She picked up a red dress, tight, bulge-clutchy, low at the bust.
How about this?
It's slutty.
It's sexy.
It costs £65.
Yes, that's cheap for a whole dress. God, the fashion industry is so wasted on you. Try it on, go on. Sometimes the best garments are the ones you'd never pick out yourself.
Well, I definitely never have picked that one out.
Okay, I'll try it on.
Are we going to Mac? I need powder.
They went to the changing room. Melissa with the red dress and a couple of tops. Hazel with a mound of skirts, trousers and blouses, several of which she bought.
Melissa bought the dress, commanded by Hazel.
Michael will love you in it. He'll eat you up.
And afterwards they went to Mac, which was situated by the main entrance in the makeup hall. It was guarded by a gang of beautified creatures in black clothes listening to dance music. The Mac ladies. They wore their makeup pouches slung on belts around their hips, from which they flipped out eye pencils, mascaras and colours to paint the faces of the week. They were deliverers of blue, scientists of pink. They knew the secrets to lifting a dull skin and mattifying a stubborn shine. They had understanding browns, many shades of it, placing them above those brands who allowed only a few dark tones to be flawless. At the entrance to the enclosure was a podium, above which a muraled face with cascading hair waited with pen and paper, making appointments for makeovers. Her eyes were meticulously designed, broad streaks of shadow, temple band, a layer of silver studs along a light blue background, and beneath this, cool green eyes staring nonchalantly out, acknowledging their hipness, their futurism. Around her, women lingered by the cabinets, trying out the glosses and putting lipstick on their hands, looking for better versions of themselves. Or they sat on high stools with their eyes closed and their faces lifted to the power of the lady, hoping for transformation. Among the staff were two gay men in tight jeans and leather waistcoats, likewise heavily made up.
"Are you okay there, babe?"
one said to Melissa, who was studying the pressed powders.
"Do you have NC-45?
"We're out of that one, sorry, babe. Do you want to try something similar? We've got a new range come out. Gives more coverage."
He slipped a compact out of one of the revolving display cabinets and opened it. Melissa said she'd try it, and her name was added to the list. A few minutes later, she was sitting on a high stool while he puffed at her face with a thick brush.
"Ah, that goes nice on you."
He dabbed and flicked with his brush some more.
"Have a look,"
and handed her a mirror. She was lightly almond, perky.
"Looks nice,"
Hazel said.
"Isn't it too dark?"
"No, gives you a glow. You're just not used to it.
That's the mistake a lot of people make with makeup. They see it and think too light, too dark, too red, too yellow or whatever, because they're so used to what they see in the mirror. But what you see in the mirror is only like a blank sheet of paper, right? It's meant for colouring in.
Exactly. That's what I was basically just saying, Hazel said. I think you should get it.
Okay, I will. Mac ran a special offer of a free lipstick if you returned 6 empty compact cases, which Melissa loaded out of her bag.
Babe, I don't mean to be rude, but your eyebrows need doing, love.
Yeah, I'm always going on at her about her eyebrows.
Changes your face, it does.
I know, I haven't had time to get them threaded lately.
Got to keep yourself beautiful. You got a lovely face, darling. Don't waste it.
See? Hazel said as they walked away, linking Melissa's arm, though she was taller, so Melissa changed it round and linked hers instead.
Don't you feel like a new woman? You've got a red dress, a new face, new lipstick. Time to get it on.
I promise you, all you and Michael need is some time alone together and you'll be sweet. Get a babysitter for a night. I'll come over and babysit if you like.
What? You? Will cross the river to babysit?
Of course I will. What do you take me for? I can see when two people need some emergency loving. You and Michael are not going to break up. I won't let it happen. I mean, if you two broke up, I'd stop believing in love. I'd stop believing there was hope for any of us.
Okay, okay, calm down, Melissa laughed, out through the revolving doors with their bags, out from the subterranean well, and back into the weather, cool air on their faces, into the pigeon-stepping crowd.
You don't need to worry, though. You've always got men in your heels. Tell me about your love life. What's happening? Anything interesting?
Hazel, going on 37, had for some time been on the lookout for the man. She did believe that there was one man, a right man, of the fairy tales, and she wanted to find him and marry him, and buy a house and have babies who would run around the garden wearing nappies that she couldn't be bothered to change. She wanted to go the traditional route, but she was beginning to worry that it might never happen.
There has been a development, actually, she said.
Really? Ooh.
His name was Pete. He was Greek-Moroccan via Harrow. They met at the milk and sugar stand in Starbucks, she putting chocolate on her cappuccino, he putting cinnamon on his latte. His shoulder half a foot higher than her shoulder, pleasingly, as she liked it. Possible prince material. They lingered. A lot of chocolate and a lot of cinnamon. Drew it out with more sugar. By the time they looked at each other, side on, these were two very sweet beverages. He smiled. She smiled. And they had a little conversation about how they liked their beverages. And then they were sitting at a table by the window talking and getting to know each other. He was a travel consultant and liked clubbing and going to the gym. He ticked all the boxes. Muscles in the forearms, apparently intelligent, sense of humour, does not live with his mum, has no children. But Hazel was not going to get ahead of herself.
You don't meet the man of your dreams in Starbucks, Melissa said.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, innit? It's like meeting someone in a club or something. But you never know. I'm leaving it to the stars. Right now, we're just hanging out. It's only been 2 months. He's gorgeous, though. He is gorgeous. He looks like Al Pacino. Let's see.
Hazel handed over her phone. He did look a bit like Al Pacino.
So have you slept with him yet?
What do you think? It's been 2 months. Of course I have. Can't you see the bags under my eyes? We're at it like rabbits. He is wild, you know, even by my standards. But he's sensitive with it. Best cunnilingus this side of Kentucky. That boy knows exactly where to flick me.
Do you mind I'm trying to eat my edamame beans? Melissa spluttered.
They were now sitting across from each other in Wagamama, waiting for their mains.
You asked.
He sounds almost too good to be true. Maybe you do meet the man of your dreams in Starbucks.
We should have a foursome sometime. You, me, Michael and Pete.
What kind of foursome?
Not that kind of foursome.
They were both laughing.
God, some people just have sex on the brain. You know I wouldn't be able to share you with anyone else.
Despite their joking, Melissa was remembering with nostalgia those exact same times of helpless, compulsive honeymoon love with Michael and feeling jealous. A foursome was a terrible idea. When new couples get together with old couples, there is only unhappiness for the latter, watching the lovebirds glow at each other and gaze at each other and lock hands uncontrollably under the table. She mumbled something vague, avoiding the suggestion. Hazel noted her non-committal tone.
But you and Michael have your twosome first. Seeing as we're on the subject, when exactly was the last time you fucked?
Do you have to be so crass? I'm serious, man. This is important. If you stop having sex, it just dies. It's the life force. It's crucial. You've just got to do it. Tell me when.
I don't know. Months. We're basically flatmates. Oh, no. Me and Ollie were like that in the end. It's horrible.
There's no time, though. I can't be all the things my life is asking me to be. It's too much. Melissa was hiding it, but she was close to tears.
But he's a man, Liz. He needs it. You've got to make time for him, otherwise you'll lose him.
I don't want to make time. Little time there is left I want for me, not him. I don't want to be answerable to someone's sex drive.
Hazel was appalled.
Jesus, listen to yourself. You're disturbing me now.
Answerable? Is that how you see it?
Yes, frankly. I'm not lovebirds anymore like you and Starbucks. It's been 13 years. How many times can you keep having sex with the same person without it becoming vapid?
What does vapid mean?
Kind of dull and flat.
Why don't you try something different then?
Like what?
I don't know. Use your imagination.
Their food arrived. Melissa was having ramen and Hazel was having vermicelli.
All I know is that you've got to make love. Men need to feel wanted. So much can go wrong when they don't feel desired. Instead of thinking of it as something you have to do for him, make it for you. Know what I mean? It's a two-way thing.
Melissa said, unconvinced.
Wear that red dress. Go on, get penetrated. Give him blowjobs. Everything will be fine.
You're so disgusting.
You know you want to,
said Hazel, and they tucked into their noodles. Thus cajoled, thus alerted to the imperatives of their partnership, their perfection, their chocolateness, Melissa and Michael went out on a date. Not to a party, no fraternizing with other people and forgetting about each other. Just the two of them. A nice, quiet dinner in a good restaurant. Some wine, some music, easy adult conversation. Perhaps followed by a walk hand in hand in the romantic winter's night. An evening of remembering each other and feeling like a couple again. Of laughing together, flirting, a tipsy, canoodly ride back home in a cab afterwards, then rounding off with some steamy, redemptive copulation. That was the plan. In preparation, for they had to look their best, dress up for each other, Melissa went to the mall in Bromley to get her eyebrows threaded. There was a pod there, where three Nepalese women worked all day, holding the string between their teeth. They hewed at her brazen follicles, snipped at stray hairs, eventually achieving a sharp, thinned-down brow, which always made her look alarmed for a couple of days until it softened. While she was there, she also bought some red high heels to go with the dress, the kind of shoes Hazel might wear. In fact, it was as if she had spotted them with Hazel's eyes. Meanwhile, Michael attended to his own follicles, setting his clippers to a close grade one and shaving 3 weeks of growth off his scalp. It always gave him a cleaner, chiseled look, and there was that promising moment when Melissa was finishing it off for him, as was their custom, gliding up with the blade from his neck to his crown, neatening the edges, rubbing at the stubborn patches. She had to stand very close to him in order to do this, between his knees, her arms raised over him. And already, they were reminded of how perfectly her smallness slotted into his largeness, his length, his octopus arms. He couldn't help but stroke lightly down the backs of her legs as she stood there, a blush of Saturday afternoon sun coming in from the window twins. It was a warm, natural moment. So there was hope. They could return. Perhaps it really was this easy. Hazel arrived in a blaze of southward trauma.
God, my sat-nav wouldn't work. It just died on me. I had to read a map. I ended up taking Vauxhall Bridge instead of Battersea. Didn't know where I was. You just need to come back to civilization, man.
Wow, you two look beautiful.
They were pictures of themselves. Oiled, snipped and perfumed. Melissa in the new lipstick and powder, the dress and shoes, darker and taller than she knew herself to be. And Michael also wearing red, a new V-neck sweater beneath a chestnut leather jacket. They were matching.
I don't know why Mummy and Daddy have to go out tonight,
Rhea said.
Why can't you just stay in and have a nice time?
She hated it when the two of them were leaving her for some private adventure. It made her feel bereft, like the world was dissolving.
Sometimes, Hazel said, adults need time on their own. And anyway, you've got me to hang out with now. What should we do?
Make cakes, watch TV, have a disco, eat cakes, make a house, have some hot chocolate, shrink, not have a bath. These were just some of the things. Rhea stood in the doorway watching them go, wearing her one white glove and her strange nightwear of cotton strap dress on top of fleece pajama suit. She watched them right up until they turned the corner into the high street, and all that was left to see was the plane tree leaning out into the road and the moon behind it. Then she went back inside. Open air, childlessness, pramlessness, and carelessness. They walked. It was a windy night. That was the first thing. It was the kind of wind that blew at you from all directions, so that whichever way you went, your hair still got trashed. Melissa got frizzy up the high street, while Michael was trying to hold her hand. Down the slope, they went to the station to take the train to Crystal Palace, where they were going to have dinner. Michael had booked a table. They were going to a secret gig afterwards as well, which Melissa did not know about. He was trying to reenact another long-ago night when he had taken her out for her birthday to the Soho Theatre. Afterwards, they had walked through the London streets in the dark, as she loved to do, bound for a restaurant in Covent Garden, holding hands, he a little way ahead, leading her. She enraptured by the mystery of it, the excitement of not knowing. Tonight was going to be just the same. He would lead her, and she would follow, enraptured. As they stood on the platform, he put his arms around her, and she sheltered in his leather coat. It was stilted, though. That was the second thing. Not like before, during the haircut. They felt that they were putting on a show for themselves and watching it uncomfortably. The train came slowly in, its low lights shining over the tracks. They got on and sat next to each other, facing the dark windows. When the Crystal Palace was still standing, when people had come from miles and miles to see the colossi of Abu Simbel and the tomb of Beni Hassan, there had been two ways to get there, via the high-level line or the low-level line. The high-level line was no longer in use. It was the low-level platform onto which Melissa and Michael disembarked, climbing the many steps up to the street after a rustling, verdant journey. The foliage thickens and closes in around the tracks along the way, as if you are going into a different world. Dutifully, hand in hand, they emerged onto the street, into this rolling, hilly town on the far south edge of London, where from the pinnacles of the steeps, the city centre is a shimmering, distant valley view of many coloured lights. You can hear seagulls, possibly bound for Brighton. It is so far out. It has a seaside sensation. And they and other birds soar amidst the peaks of the two Eiffels, the taller standing in the park on the flat plain of Crystal Palace Parade, the shorter at the top of Beulah Hill towards Thornton Heath. Up they walked in the frizzing wind towards Westo Hill, where all the restaurants were. There were lots of people about, spruced up for Saturday night, people who had moved out here for affordable places to live, thus joining in with the endless expansion of the city, bringing Kent and Bromley into the party, making Brixton central and Dulwich hip. With these people had come the trendy furniture boutiques and Whole Food juice bars, the vintage clothes shops, and the indigenous folk, those who had watched all this happen, carried on in their own sweet way. The boys who came down from the tower blocks with their dogs, the old folk who couldn't believe the price of a flannel in Sainsbury's these days. There were other couples too, walking hand in hand, more naturally, peering at the menus in the windows beneath the awnings. The place Michael had booked was one of those chic and stately modern places with elegant chairs and no music, where the food is considered the only music necessary, and actual music an unnecessary distraction. There was gold panelling around the doors and windows, light grey tablecloths. A stern, unsmiling host placed them next to a pillar in the centre of the room, neither discreet nor intimate, and they struggled in this classy sterility to vibe. Melissa ate wood pigeon for the first time in her life and didn't feel right about it. They tried hard not to talk about the children, but it was difficult, and they ended up talking about the mice. Between intermittent silences, they sipped from their different wines, his red, hers white. At the next table sat an old couple who also had nothing to talk about and had given up trying to make it look as if they did, both of them with tight looks on their faces and deadened eyes. "You look beautiful," Michael tried at some point between the mains and desserts. At exactly the same instant, the candle in the middle of their table went out. "Thanks," Melissa said. A deep melancholy was rising within her. She wanted to be miles away from him, but they were here. And here was her chocolate cake. It had a bitter orange peel edge, a dark chocolate cream running out of it. She ate it with a grave and absolute absorption. When the desserts were finished, Michael checked his watch. "You ready?" he said. "What for?" "Come on." He got up and pulled out her chair for her. He held open her coat as she slipped in. And it was something, these small attentions. It might still turn out well. Around the corner, off Westo Hill, there was a black car parked at the curb. A man got out as Michael approached it. They conferred for a while, then Michael opened the door for Melissa to get in. "Where are we going?" she asked him. But she was beginning to enjoy the mystery, to remember. The evening was changing. Michael just smiled. He got in next to her, and they took off at some speed down the hill. The driver was playing loud R&B. He was a bald, plump Ghanaian in a black polo shirt, the Ghanaian flag dancing from his rearview mirror. He drove like a maniac, down and up over Crystal Hills, through the southern quarters, ripped through them as if he were evil, as if he were Knievel, as if there were no paying customers in his car. Melissa leaned into the enclave of Michael's arm, grey tinge of night leaves in the curves of honor oak, flares of lime flowers and holly leaves in the secret crescents. They flew by. The driver knew all these back streets. Silver birches were here, then gone. Mere suggestions in the night and the speed, other trees, fast lights, sweeps of green. He beeped at slower cars, driving right up to their bumpers. He jerked at turns. Every brake was an emergency. When he almost jumped a red light, Melissa was thrown forward in her seat. "Will you slow down?" she shouted over the music. "Sorry, sorry." The driver slowed, momentarily, bopping to Jodeci, but soon charged off again. The next time he slowed down was to swing into a petrol station, where he pulled up next to one of the tanks and got out. "Wait now, back in a minute," he said. "Hey, you can't stop for petrol when you've got customers," Melissa balked. He filled the tank anyway and went off to the kiosk. Michael refused to pay him the whole fare, which Melissa said was only right. "We're your customers, not your homies." Looking at her in his rearview mirror, the driver said, "You are from Nigeria, I know."
"I'm half Nigerian."
"Your mother or your father is Nigerian?"
"My mother."
"Hey, I know," he chuckled. "You are just like my wife. She is always making trouble."
He chuckled some more and drove on with continuing recklessness towards the river, along the vast urban tarmac of the A2, turned off at the exit to the O2, and there ahead of them was that once-failed Millennium Dome, with its 12 yellow cranes sticking out of it like monstrous and very painful acupuncture, pointing to specific points in the solar system, a suggestion of alien transmission. So much grand expectation had been placed on this building at the turn of the century, to be mighty, to be showy, to be somehow sci-fi, and they had gone too far futuristic with it and forgotten all about beauty. People were disappointed with the thing after all that hype, and once the new century had begun, no one knew what to do with it for a while. What do you do with an empty 80,000 square meter disc-shaped spaceship grounded in an ugly concrete desert off the A2? What else? You give it to music. Let music make it sing. Here in this enormous space, in these stretching auditoriums, pop stars and crooners, the angels of the modern age, delivered their voices. Prince had sung Kiss Here, wearing a pair of high-heeled white boots. The Spice Girls had made a comeback over 17 consecutive nights. Beyoncé would come and swing on a flowery trapeze with her weave flowing. The O2 was the Wembley of the South Side, and it had better acoustics, most of all in the Indigo 2, the smaller auditorium where the lesser divinities sang. The ones not quite arena famous, the niche, the lovers rock lineups, the R&B revivals, a jazz hip-hop soulstress from Philadelphia known as Jill Scott, who stood there, swaying in green smoke and a misty light, as Melissa and Michael entered.
"It's Jill," Melissa said.
"Yeah, it's Jill." She was their early music, the music of the palace, the seventh sky. She had seeped through the rooms with her honey molasses and her love moans, her hip-hop beats, which sometimes pumped and churned and then slowed again, or disappeared entirely. Jill Scott, shimmering before them in pale green smoke. It lifted from the stage, whispering to her afro puffs, wafting around the band. The backing singers wore black and did the finger-clicking gospel two-step. The pianist was lost in jazz, and Jill was gently dancing, her wealthy waist, her wide American smile, her voice deep and saccharine at the same time. From a distance away, her eyes glittered. The lights went pink, went yellow. She was singing, "Do You Remember?" In between songs, she made chains of words. Whether she was speaking or singing, her voice was constant melody. In the audience were soulheads and hip-hop fans, observers of the culture, head-wrapped Afrocentrics, and followers of the new jazz. Couples swayed against each other, intoxicated by her sound. There were single people sipping at her wisdom, men in good shirts looking for women, knowing that this was a place to find them, that Jill would make them open and heat them up inside. Jill had the power to make a world, with her sweetness, her girlishness, which was soft and malleable and wholly woman. Sometimes she sang hard, "Wanna Be Loved." Sometimes the guitar stilled and she brought her voice down to a whisper, and everyone in the room, if they closed their eyes, felt almost that she was whispering only to them. They listened, spinning on her axes. The trombone went submarine, trumpets cascaded in flashes of gold. In the middle of a song, Melissa felt Michael's hand on her waist. He wanted to dance with her, in a gentle closing around her. With his arms, he sent them moving. He behind her, she with her back to him. But here, even here, in this musical mirage, there was something else that was not right. They didn't dance right. They never had danced quite right together, because of how they were different inside when it came to rhythm. Melissa was obedient to it, directed by it. She danced on top of the beat. But Michael instead went inside it, and did his own thing, slower than the beat, loose and nonchalant, as though he believed that his inner rhythm was superior to that provided by the music. The effect was that as they swayed, they did not sway as one. There was friction, a slight forcing. Halfway through the song, the music slowed down again. The trumpets hushed, the drums subsided, the piano watered down until it was gone. A single blue spotlight centered on Jill. She was going to talk to them again.
"Ladies," she said.
"Fellas,
I want to tell you something. Can I tell you something? Come here. Come closer."
The audience stilled. They were held in her palm, in this big disc by the river, huddled in her light.
"Tonight," Jill said, "I stand before you, a divorced woman."
The music returned for a brief twirl and subsided again.
"Yeah, I was married, and I gave him all of my heart. I gave him everything. We were happy in our love, in the morning, in the evening, in those cold night hours. I loved him all the way through. I was married for life, for always.
But do you know what he did, ladies? Do you know what that man did?"
"What?"
the women called.
"Well, he went to somebody else's house."
"Hmm,
Yeah. You'd think he would have known there was nobody else like me. Nobody's love so fine like mine. Now she was fully singing again. One is the magic number. It was a message for the world, but it seemed to come directly for them. It was the loudest moment of all. Louder than the trumpets, the brass, even than the finale when Jill came back on for an encore. The music that had married them was now telling them to divorce. There was no more dancing after that. Michael went to the bar, and while he was gone, Melissa looked around her at all the other people, other couples, other men, and wondered. Those words were sitting on a swing in a back garden in her mind, going back and forth. I stand before you, a divorced woman. The drive home was quiet, very quiet. There was no canoodling in the back seat, and the tipsiness was private and going dry. As they approached Belle Green, the disappointment of the evening thickened. It manifested in the bleakness of the high street, the stony mannequins in their bridal gowns, the sinking into Kent. In the distance, the towers were half cut by a thick fog that had descended, smothering their peaks, so that they were half of themselves. And this man and woman, sitting in the back of the cab, were just like those two towers, in their distance from one another, their separateness. He was Beulah, and she was Crystal. And there seemed no way, in this fog, in this pretense, that they might come together as one. The cab turned into Paradise Row and slowed at number 13. The house glared out at them with its narrow face, the window twins murky, foreboding, tightly shut against the cold. Hazel was mid-doze on the sofa in front of Four Music, where a host of bikinied girls were languishing around Nellie's musculature. She came to at their footsteps.
Oh, hi, you're back. I conked out. How was it?
Good, they both said, their faces tight, like the old couple in the restaurant.
We went to see Jill Scott, Melissa added. Did you? Oh, yeah, I heard she was playing. Was she good?
And while they filled her in on the amazingness of Jill, that voice, that sass, what poetry, a hard, nudging pressure built up in their midst, reminding them of what they all knew must now be done. That thing up in the Red Room, that overdue sail, the drowning ship. Hazel started getting her stuff together, her nail varnish, her Russian hat, and her red coat.
By the way, she said before she left, does Rhea sleepwalk? I found her standing at the top of the stairs, and she didn't hear me when I called her. I took her back to bed and everything. She's fine. It was just a bit weird, that's all.
Soon afterwards, she was bound for the West with her sat-nav, which was working again, and craving Pete, hoping that she had contributed in some way tonight to the preservation of long-term romantic love in London, while her chocolate pair were left stranded in their hallway, burdened by the task ahead.
I'm going to check on them, Melissa said. She had that flash again of Lily under the skylight as she was going up the stairs. Except that now it was Rhea under the skylight, asleep, unhearing as Hazel called to her. She was glad of this distraction. She had been hoping for Blake's bleating cry, a pressing need, a detour. But both of them were supine in their swathes of cotton, breathing deeply. Blake lying on his front with his mouth open and one tiny arm stretched upwards. She rearranged his blanket, for it was cold in there, colder than usual. Most of all, next to Rhea's bed, closest to the window. Looking down at her, the crescents of her lashes were completely still. A sliver of moon lay across her cheek. She wished that she could sink into the newness of their years, that she could fall into their innocence. It was such a strong wish that for a moment she had the sensation that she was falling down into Rhea's body, and she was not sure anymore whose mind she was in. When she left the room, there was a sadness, faint, but definite, enough to make her look back, that this childhood room was no longer her world. He was waiting for her. Passion, at its truest and most fierce, does not liaise with toothpaste. It does not wait around for toning and exfoliation. It wants spontaneity. It wants recklessness. Passion is dirty. And they were too clean. Once their faces were washed,
their mouths freshened, the doors, windows, cooker and taps checked so that the house would not burn, flood or explode. Michael had wanted to undress her, to prise her out of the red dress in the red room, but he was again too late. By the time he got there, she was hanging the dress up in the wardrobe. She was wearing the rich cappuccino gown, the same color as the raffia. He took in the sight of her, the shape of her gentle brown waist and the soft, shadowy dunes of her thighs beneath the satin. Oh, how she threw him, electrified him, by doing almost nothing, just standing there with her back to him, her gold arms raised. He wanted to drink from her sweetness and break her until she was set to flowing. He wanted to take her higher, like a legend, past the sublime plateau, into the wild and peaceful air of the ninth cloud. Tonight, he was going to lift them up from under this old love and make it new again. But the wardrobe is so dusty, Melissa was thinking. So much dust on my red dress, on my clothes. The air in here is so old. The floor is creaking. The window is shivering. It needs fixing. He hasn't fixed it. She tried her best to relax as he kissed her neck. But the light was still on. It was freezing. She wanted to get under the covers. Once these things were done, she tried once more to relax, to think of the sensation, how nice it was. This is a nice thing that people do together. A nice, gentle stroll along the calm water's edge. And it is available to you, this warm, relaxing thing. Think about nothing else. She held his head with her palm. It felt like the fur on a newly skinned animal. She wandered across the plane of his back and his whip marks with trailing fingers as he smelt her for chicken but found none. He was breathing deeply, quickly. He was racing towards her, in fact almost past her. She could hardly keep up. The kiss. Kissing her on the mouth. This is the center, the core. This is how you know. He kissed her, a long, moist, demanding kiss. But it was so far away from that first, fully formed kiss, the one with its own psychology and personality. Desdemona was not around. Neither was Angelina. It was dry despite its moistness, neither swirling nor euphoric. And he had the feeling, as he was kissing her, that while she was kissing him, she was also pulling away from him. This kiss was mean and finite, whereas Desdemona had been infinite and boundless, was in some form possibly existing, even now, in some other young new kiss. A little saddened, he drew up, unbuckled his belt. There was a scramble between them to pull away the denim, she out of an eagerness to be proactive and helpful, and he out of her failure to be the latter. He became self-conscious at the falling fabric, too aware of his feet, one of which got caught in the hem as he was trying to struggle out, so that he lost his balance and almost fell down on top of her. With the socks, it was no more graceful. He stood up to take them off to avoid further stumbling, the floorboards groaning beneath his weight, an ugly serenade to their clumsy foreplay. But you can't make love in socks unless passion allows it. Meanwhile, Melissa shrugged off her gown. Her skin was free. His skin was free. The light next to his heart, the shape of a boomerang, which made the skin a touch yellower there, was free. He came back to her. There was another, meeker kiss, warmer and tender this time, though still not wholly satisfying, so he moved southward to seek a better kiss in her breastplate. The left, the right. This old order. This weather-beaten script. She yearned for something new, something else. He wished that she would tell him what she liked, where she wanted to be touched, with what pressure. He didn't know anymore. He couldn't read her. Michael had always tried to propose a path of adventure, to keep things interesting. Adventures, he believed, were in the cavities of what already exists, in the folds and possibilities of your own life. You do not need to travel to the southeastern coast of Corfu, or climb the Andes or go to Chile. You can travel right here, in spasms and leaps, to heavens close by. He had tried new things, new shapes, different kisses, bolder gestures,
But such flamboyance was wasted on her. She was no match for his level of aspiration, and eventually, reluctantly, he had accepted this slow moderation of the burning inside of him and succumbed to routine. They had become missionaries, she below, he above. After all, it worked. It was highly adequate. And all was quiet, so very quiet. Hardly a moan, hardly a tremor. Melissa let it continue, this grazing around breastplate, along torso, concentrating on the feeling, the actual biology of it. But her mind was wandering. Blake's blanket, school dinner money, mice who might be coming upstairs, the night thing, Rhea under the skylight. But then he kissed her hip bone. And when Michael kissed her hip bone, that meant only one thing, the next thing. That lush and rhythmic licking, the thing she always came back for. If she was sailing over the southeastern coast of Corfu, or climbing a mountain in Peru, or considering celibacy. He stayed there a long time, calling her, swirling her, drowning richly. Her sex to him was a celebration. Its soft and falling walls, its avalanching liquid. She was a waterfall. She stretched out the blankets over them to keep them both warm, and she lay there with her arms by her sides, swimming out to him, in a kind of soft self-erasure, for part of her still remained elsewhere, was in a cave, where the truest part of her lived, waiting for the glorious summit to pass, that frightening, yet delicious surging, that, oh my God, what's going to happen, sensation, which often felt to her like rising to a peak with great expectation, and the peak being less than what was promised. An explosion that disappeared as it happened, or a train arriving at a station that was no longer there. Afterwards, she felt that she should return the gesture, and she held him in her hand, but her hand was dishonest. This dishonesty had an effect on her heart, was a kind of poison, though she continued with it, the sense of terrible duty. She took him in her mouth, made flowers on the head with her tongue, making everything seem all right for a while, almost natural. And he surged and came up full again. Yet there was something cold and clinical about it all. He still, even now, did not feel fundamentally desired. He was racing, reaching, breathless. She was cool, reticent, retreating. They were not flying. There was no ninth cloud in sight. They had not even left Belle Green. Irritated with her, yet ready, needing, he went inside and she received him. It took her breath away, how he filled her. But so disappointed did he feel at the prospect that it should end like this, in this awful monotony, that in a ferocious reach for that legendary cloud, he encouraged her to turn over, though she didn't quite want to, so she clung to him, resisting. With these conflicting longings, they rolled onto their sides in complete disharmony, until she gave in, feeling herself fading, becoming just biology, just the science. For the sake of love, for the sake of chocolate, for the sake of their children, she did what he wanted. This, however, was not Melissa's favourite shape. The length of him was such that he reached right to the end of her, and, unable to go any further, shoved and bulged against her, causing an unpleasant ache. "Ow!" she said. "Does it hurt? Lift up." "No, it's okay," she said, not wanting to prolong.